From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Timothy Cole was a 26-year-old student at Texas Tech when a judge sent him away for 25 years, a sentence for a rape he did not commit. Through multiple parole hearings, Timothy maintained his innocence. He died behind bars 9 years ago. Now, DNA evidence and a confession by another convicted rapist show he was wrongfully convicted. But Texas doesn't have a formal process to exonerate someone who has already died. In a few moments, we'll hear from Timothy Cole's mother and from the rape victim whose testimony helped convict him. But first, we have the chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas, Jeff Blackburn, to give us the background on the case of Timothy Cole and the effort to clear his name. Jeff, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
Let's begin with this. How did the Timothy Cole case come to the attention of the Innocence Project?
Well, about a year ago, we got a letter from a guy in prison that said, not I'm innocent, but instead I'm guilty, and explained to us that he had that he was doing time for other crimes, that a man named Tim Cole had been tried for a crime that he had, in fact, committed, and we followed up on it.
What has been done since then, and what still needs to be done to achieve a formal exoneration from the state of Texas for Timothy Cole?
Well, there's an enormous amount. The first problem is that the court system in Texas is addicted to convictions and not very up on exonerations. We have created a very political system here in which egos are involved, politics are involved, and it's very, very difficult for judges and prosecutors to ever admit that that they've convicted innocent people. Because of that, we're running into a lot of obstacles.
Do you have to have what would amount to another trial? Or explain to the listeners what precisely has to be done to have the record changed.
Sure. We have found an old procedure in Texas law called the Court of Inquiry, which seems to fit perfectly the situation. Under this procedure, we can go to court and ask for a full hearing into the issue of who's guilty of this crime, what went wrong in the case, and everything that happened in between. We think that that's not only something we have a right to and something that would be good under the law, but we think that's the only way we're ever going to be able to examine what really happened in this case and hopefully prevent this from occurring in the future.
In order for that to happen, this court of inquiry, who has to approve it?
We have to find a district judge somewhere in Texas that has got the guts to stand up and say that the system was wrong, that it did wrong not only to Tim Cole and his family, but also to the original victim in this case, and to begin to make those conclusions about what went wrong. Now, we're hopeful that we're going to be able to get that done. We tried in Lubbock County. Frankly, we weren't surprised when the Lubbock authorities turned us down. The prosecutor that prosecuted this case and that framed Timothy Cole is now a judge there. None of them want to upset the good old boy club that's currently in existence in Lubbock County. So now we're taking our case to Austin. We believe that the district judge is there, especially given the fact that it's the state capital, maybe more inclined to do the right thing and more inclined to give us the hearing that we desperately need to clear his name for once and for all.
We should let our audience know that we here at News and Notes did ask the Lubbock County District Attorney about the court of inquiry process that you make reference to. Matthew Powell, the Lubbock DA, said, and this is a quote, "This is a unique situation, and usually there is a very specific procedure. This has never been done before," end quote. When asked further whether his office opposed the inquiry and why, Powell said it was a decision of the judge and not of the DA. Anything further, he said, quote, "You'll have to ask the judge about that." My question to you is the DA joining you in this effort to try to get a court of inquiry set up?
No, that's buck passing of the worst kind, and it's what we've gotten used to in this case. As you'll hear from other folks, the DA's office has been reluctant to step up and do the right thing. We're glad that they did the DNA testing. We're not happy that they didn't involve us in the process. We're not happy that they're not doing what at least one district attorney in Texas, Craig Watkins in Dallas, has been willing to do, and that's try to correct some of these injustices. But I've got to tell you, this is very, very typical behavior, and it's the sort of thing that my project has begun to expect from virtually every other DA in the state. They just don't want to admit that their system does wrong.
Where is the person who confessed to the crime now?
He's sitting in prison in a little town called Snyder, Texas, about 120 miles south of Lubbock.
Jeff, I want to ask you to hold on for a moment because we're going to bring into the conversation two women who are intimately involved with the Timothy Cole case. The first is Ruby Sessions. She is the mother of the late Timothy Cole. And the second is Michelle Mallon. She is the rape victim whose testimony helped to convict Cole back in 1986. Ruby, Michelle, thank you both for coming on News and Notes.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Ruby, let me begin with you. Timothy was your oldest son. Tell us what it was like visiting him in prison all of those years, believing that he was, in fact, an innocent man.
We always knew he was innocent. Timothy knew that, too. It was very, very hard to go to see him and then leave, coming back to Fort Worth, knowing that there were some things going on that were not conducive for his health.
How did he handle it? What did he say to you when you would go visit?
His main thing was, I want to be exonerated and totally vindicated from this crime. And he couldn't understand why Michelle picked him out. He didn't live to hear from her and from Jeff and all those others who are working on the case as to how she could have picked his picture out. That's another story, because in the lineup, the pictures taken from police files, Tim's picture was a Polaroid picture, and the description of the rapist for Michelle did not match my son in any shape, form, or fashion.
Well, let me stop there to bring Michelle into the conversation. And Michelle, we appreciate your coming on. I'd like to start with this. You were the victim of a brutal rape on March 24th, 1985, in a Lubbock, Texas church parking lot. In all those years since the trial, did you ever doubt that your identification of Timothy Cole was accurate?
I never doubted it. I honestly was shocked when I found out on May 21st of this year when George White from the Lubbock DA's office contacted me. I mean, I thought he was getting out of prison. I didn't know he died 9 years ago. So, no, I never had any doubt. And in my mind, I really honestly believed that they had found the right guy. I thought that, you know, they didn't tell me their evidence. I just assumed they had other forensic evidence. And it looked to me like, I mean, I really honestly believed he was the one.
Have you been able to ask yourself how, even though you were convinced that he was the one, that it turns out, if the DNA evidence is correct, that he, in fact, was not the one?
Have I what now?
Have you ever been able to figure out or ask yourself how you could have come to the wrong conclusion?
I've asked myself that 1,000 times ever since I got that phone call in May. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, unless I was just so traumatized or something, I don't know. I really don't. I really honestly believe that it looked like him to me. It really did, and I thought that was him.
Now, Ruby, tell us about the day that you found out about the DNA results.
Jeff Blackburn called one of my sons and I about 8 o'clock on a Friday night and said that the DNA come back and it was this guy in Snyder, Texas. And we celebrated a little bit, but we were cautiously optimistic until the final results came in. So it's bittersweet, but we're just hoping that a judge somewhere here in the state will let Jeff have this hearing.
Now, we're going to ask both of you to hold on. In a moment, we're going to take a break, and I want to talk about the fact that you met, you, Michelle, and you, Ruby, for the first time last Friday, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yes.
So we're going to talk about what that meeting was like. Jeff, you're still there?
I sure am.
Really quickly, is there a time frame at all that's involved in moving this forward?
Well, it's going to be up to the judge. The best we can do is bring it to the attention of the courts now in Travis County. We plan on filing this petition on Thursday. And after that, it's going to be up to the system itself to see if they're willing to rectify this horrible, horrible, tragic error.
If you are successful, it would be, would it not, the first time in the history of the state of Texas that someone who has been convicted of a crime was exonerated posthumously.
That's correct.
All right, hold on. Like we said, we're going to come back and continue this conversation with both of you, with all three of you. We're talking with Jeff from the Innocence Project. We're talking with Ruby Session, the mother of the late Timothy Cole. We're also speaking with Michelle Mallon, who was the rape victim whose testimony sent him to prison back in 1986. This is News and Notes. We'll be right back. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back with Jeff Blackburn, chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas. He is leading the effort to posthumously exonerate Timothy Cole. Ruby Session is Cole's mother, and Michelle Mallon is the rape victim whose testimony sent Cole to prison. She is now helping to clear his name. Welcome back. Let me begin with you, Michelle and Ruby. This is a tragic situation, and there are victims all around. But for the mother of a man who died in prison and who was convicted wrongly, and for a victim of rape who was a part of sending that person to prison, for the two of you to meet for the first time face-to-face just last Friday must have been an emotional moment. Ruby, was it?
It was. I had talked to her about a month ago on the telephone, and I was anxious to see her. I have no animosity now, never have. Did the family have any animosity towards Michelle? We said she had been raped, but we all knew that it was not Timothy. She had our sympathy, but in meeting her last Friday, she had apprehension, saying that she, in her mind all the way over from the airport, that she thought how we might dislike her, hate her even. And so I tried to dispel all those fears by letting her know that she was victimized just as my son was, and we never had any animosity toward her. So I tried to reassure her that we never said, never doubted, that those things did not happen to her. But the only thing was that we knew for certain is that my son did not do it because of the way the arrest went down and then the way the trial was conducted.
Well,
so
let me bring Michelle in. Michelle, how apprehensive were you about meeting Ruby and the family?
Well, I was just kind of, I mean, when I first found out about it on May 21st, I mean, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, his family probably hates me. That was just what I thought. And I thought, you know, I never dreamed they would want to even talk to me or see me or anything. And then I get this, you know, email from Sarah Hagee from the, she sent it to my cousin in Abernathy, and then my cousin forwarded it to my mom, and my mom forwarded it to me and saying that the family was, you know, she sent me in the email Corey, the youngest brother's cell phone number, and saying that they would love to talk to me and all this stuff. And I was just shocked. I never dreamed that. So, I mean, because I just assumed they probably just couldn't stand me, and as you know, as they had every right to, and as in my eyes. And I was very apprehensive on Friday. I was scared that, you know, I was just nervous.
Where did this meeting take place, and how long did it last, Michelle?
It was at Corey's house, Timothy's youngest brother's.
And how long were you there?
I don't know. I guess an hour and a half. I don't know, a couple. It seems like it was a couple hours, an hour and a half to 2 hours. I don't know.
So when you left, when she left, let me ask you, Ruby, did you feel that you had made an important connection that would help Timothy?
I was just happy to know that she would come and meet us. The most important thing in that meeting was for us to let her know that we had no hard feelings toward her, because she had nothing to ask our forgiveness for, and I was just happy that the story was out. But before I finish, I'll just say this. We took Michelle to the cemetery so that she could see where Timothy is buried and let her have some moments to say whatever she had to say to him along the lines of the things that she had said to us when we first met.
Our time is running short, and let me bring you back in, Jeff, for one last comment, and it's this. When you have the victim who is now recanting and who is supporting the efforts to have Timothy Cole exonerated, we have less than a minute for your answer. Is that not enough to get the court of inquiry that you're looking for?
Well, it should be. We've already found moral redemption. Now we need legal redemption.
And you're hoping that that's going to happen?
I'm still enough of a believer in the court system, even in Texas, to think that somewhere, someplace, there's a judge who's willing to say what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong.
Michelle, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And the same to you, Ruby. Thank you for coming on as well. It's a fascinating story that you all have to tell.
Thank you very much.
Jeff Blackburn is the chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas. He is leading the effort to posthumously exonerate Timothy Cole. Ruby Session is Timothy Cole's mother. Her son was wrongfully convicted of rape, dying in prison while serving his sentence. And Michelle Mallon is the victim of rape whose testimony sent Timothy Cole to prison. She is now helping with the formal efforts to have his name cleared. Time now for our Africa update. This week in South Africa, President Thabo Mbeki resigns after pressure to step down from his own party. What's next for the country? And in Zimbabwe, rival political parties agree to share power in the new government. But how will it work? For more, we've got Amira Wood. She is co-director of foreign policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hi, Amira.
Hey, Tony. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you. Boy, a lot of stuff going on.
It's always exciting in African politics, let me tell you.
My. Over the weekend, South African President, of course, Thabo Mbeki, announced his resignation, the move coming after leaders of his own governing African National Congress threatened to force him out of office just months before his term expired early next year.
I would like sincerely to thank the nation and the ANC for having given me the opportunity to serve in public office during the last 14 years as the Deputy President and President of South Africa. This service has at all times been based on the vision, the principles and values that have guided the ANC as it prosecuted a difficult and dangerous struggle in the decades before the attainment of our freedom in 1994.
So, Amira, almost a dozen key members of the South African cabinet, in fact, more than a dozen, say they are resigning along with Mbeki, who was to step down officially on Thursday. And a South African newspaper just reported today that Mbeki says he is going to appeal the case which led to his resignation. So what's going on and how is this about to play out?
Well, let me tell you, it's an interesting and complicated deal. What has happened is you have elections scheduled in South Africa in March of 2009. But what happened in December, about a year ago, really, was that the African National Congress, which is the dominant party in South Africa, had a split of forces. You had Mbeki's faction, and Mbeki's seen as being really more the intellectual, but a bit aloof from the people. And you had Zuma's faction, you know, Zuma seen as the populist within the African National Congress, getting tremendous support and actually winning the party election, which no one had anticipated. So what you had in this fissure within the African National Congress is a split of leadership, and you have had some factions backing Mbeki and others backing Zuma. So clearly we have had a legal case with Zuma going forward on questions really of corruption issues around an arms deal and all of that. The legal case ended just about a week ago with the judge saying there was political manipulation of this legal process. Didn't name any names, but essentially put it out there that there were hands behind the scenes pulling some strings. And so what that led to was then these factions that were already opposed to Mbeki seizing the moment to say Mbeki must go. And so there was pressure building over towards the end of last week and throughout the last few days for, in fact, Mbeki to resign. And he did do that. He put forward his resignation on Saturday. And what you have just reported is hot off the press. The news is that there are several key ministers who are either threatening or actually putting forward their resignation. I think what is significant, though, is that the finance minister, Trevor Manuel, has said quite firmly, this has just come out also on Bloomberg and other reports, that he will stay. He has backed this transition to the Zuma or potentially to this transition president. And it could well be that that one of the deputy presidents of the ANC, Mutlante, takes over. What will happen on Thursday is that Parliament gets to ratify all of this. Will there be a transition for the next 6 months before the election? It's Parliament that will make the final decision on Thursday. So all these issues of appeal or counter-appeal, all of this will play into what's debated in Congress, in Parliament in South Africa later this
week. Now, the African National Congress party leader, Jacob Zuma, has informally named one of his allies to replace Mbeki, Kgalema Motlanthe, I think
Motlanthe,
I'm saying.
Motlanthe, yes,
that's
yes.
That was close. Who is he?
He is a trade unionist, so he comes out of a very powerful trade union background in South Africa. He is seen as well-respected and well-liked, but he's seen as someone who will continue the status quo. And let's remember, Mbeki came about, again, after being the deputy president to Mandela, but putting forward this grand bargain where corporations, investors, will have an environment where they will essentially have their way in the economy. The economy will be pro-corporations. So there is a tug, especially now when the wealth gap has so widened in South Africa, with the majority of the people feeling completely left out, you know, and without any of the gains that they had anticipated after the apartheid era ended.
Well, now let's move on to talk about Zimbabwe. And there's a connection between Zimbabwe and what's going on in South Africa. Now, last week in Zimbabwe, the country's longstanding political rivals signaled a landmark power-sharing deal. After you and I finish talking, we're going to hear, in fact, from Arthur Mutambara, Zimbabwe's new deputy prime minister and a leader of a breakaway faction of the Movement for Democratic Change. But before we get to him, let's talk about this agreement between Robert Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai, who assumes the newly created post of prime minister, and how the departure of Thabo Mbeki, who was a key player in bringing those two sides together, how his departure is now going to impact whether or not this agreement will hold up.
Well, let me tell you, Tony, like I said, it is never a dull moment. So clearly Mbeki has played a critical role. His quiet diplomacy was heavily criticized, but at the end of the day, together with the African Union and the Southern African Development Community, that regional body there, Mbeki was able to craft this deal with the Zimbabwean people that many say could work. But, you know, the devil is still in the details. And while a lot of the bigger elements of the deal have been worked out in terms of what will happen, particularly between Mugabe and also, you know, just in how this will all play out with Tsvangirai. But there are other ministries that are still not yet resolved. So, in fact, the negotiations is still not completed. And Mbeki's role is still pivotal in that. So there are a lot of shifting pieces in Southern Africa right now. And I think clearly what you have in Zimbabwe is a deal that's been hobbled together. It's not a perfect situation. What needs to happen is a transitional process that will essentially get the economy of Zimbabwe back in order again and also create a political space that can move towards some type of an electoral process where the will of the people can finally be heard.
Well, let's talk about the will of the people. In fact, we have some of the will of the people for our listeners to listen to in response to what they see occurring with regard to this power-sharing deal in Zimbabwe. Here they are.
I've been waiting for quite some time, actually, for the deal to be successful. But I'm very skeptical, you know, about the outcome of the deal.
We are not all that concerned about who is going to be who. But what we are concerned of is, are they going to address the critical issues in Zimbabwe to address the people's interests?
It sounds like they don't care who is in charge, so long as whoever is in charge takes care of the issues, the serious issues facing Zimbabwe and the economy.
Clearly, you have had an economy in absolute collapse. People are unable to get food to put on the table to feed their kids. They are unable, even those with the meager resources there, are unable to even find goods in the stores. So you have had people saying this economy cannot continue under these circumstances. The people of Zimbabwe have in so many ways voted with their feet, leaving the country across the borders to South Africa, to wherever they can find jobs and find a meaningful livelihood. And so the test will be, can this deal get the sanction of the Zimbabwean people to return home, to be able to be a part of a process that rebuilds an economy that actually serves their needs and serves their interests? I mean, I think this is still to be proven.
It seems as if the power sharing is still not equal in many ways. And in one regard, Tsvangirai still doesn't have a passport. Mugabe came to the States for the United Nations meeting, and Tsvangirai cannot get out of the country. Is that right?
Well, it's something that's still being debated. And, you know, the question is, who comes to the state dinners when there are state dinners? And I guess the other example here has been Kenya, where, in fact, you have an agreement to alternate, you know, key appearances in international fora. So, again, in the case of Zimbabwe, the ink is not yet dry and the deal is not yet done. So many of these finer details are still being negotiated, which is why the whole positioning of South Africa's resigned President Mbeki will really be a test as to whether or not this deal can be finished and finalized and approved by the Zimbabwean people.
I've been trying to figure this out, and I don't know if you have the answer in the time that we have left, which is just about a minute. Who this seems to help, the departure of Mbeki? I know that Tsvangirai yesterday called it a blow. One could assume perhaps that he's feeling that this is worse for him than it is for Mugabe, but I'm not sure about that.
Well, it's difficult to say. I think clearly the style that Mbeki took throughout this negotiations has been so heavily criticized. Many have said he sided with Mugabe because they were, you know, allies back in the liberation days. And, you know, and clearly we saw the words from Morgan Tsvangirai just yesterday, you know, with expressing regret that Mbeki's leaving. So I think there have been changes along the way in this negotiations process. And I think Mbeki, along with the African Union and the Southern African Development Community, they're all seen as a package that has finally brought a deal that many people, though they realize is not perfect, may be able to live with. And so changing the key players at this pivotal moment is seen as a risky venture.
All right. Amira, thank you very much. Very interesting information. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Can I tell you, shall I count the words? I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Last week, Zimbabwe's long-standing political rivals signed a landmark power-sharing deal, but negotiations over cabinet positions are still deadlocked. In the agreement, Robert Mugabe will continue as head of state. Morgan Tsvangirai, who heads the largest faction of the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, will assume the newly created post of prime minister. And Arthur Mutambara, leader of a breakaway faction of the Movement for Democratic Change, is the new deputy prime minister. Mutambara spoke with NPR's Farai Chidea about his new position and how the historic agreement was made.
Insofar far as I'm concerned, this is just but the beginning. The hard work starts right now. So we're very anxious to get started, and we are very anxious so that we can actually deliver on the promises of the dialogue process. We feel that the people of Zimbabwe have gone through so much suffering, and they deserve a new dispensation. So we feel poised and ready to work hard and deliver and improve the material conditions of our people.
Now, as Deputy Prime Minister, what do you expect your responsibilities to be?
Well, the Deputy Prime Minister position is essentially a supportive role where the two Deputy Prime Ministers work with the Prime Minister to execute the duties and responsibilities of the Prime Minister. We are going to discuss further, you know, responsibilities and tasks to be executed by the Deputy Prime Ministers, and we'll be able to articulate and discuss those at a later stage. But we are saying that this is a compromise agreement. This is an inclusive government where we all have to work together so that we can deliver and make the agreement a practical agreement which can actually resolve the humanitarian, political, and economic crisis that has been gripping our country for the past 6 weeks.
Now, President Robert Mugabe has said that he was, quote, humiliated by the power-sharing agreement. What does it mean to you to hear him say that or hear that he said that?
We are very determined to look forward. We are very determined to think about the future. Insofar as we are concerned, the people of Zimbabwe voted for change. The people of Zimbabwe voted for some kind of power sharing. There was no outright winner in the elections for parliament. There was no outright winner in the elections for president. So the elections themselves, the 29th of March, has forced Zimbabwean political leaders to work together. That is what we have done. And we are not interested in any positions that seek to undermine or misunderstand the essence of power sharing. So I will not even go there. I will not even entertain a discussion about humiliation. I will entertain a discussion about the demand by the people of Zimbabwe that all the political leaders must work together. Put national interest before personal interest. Put national interest before partisan interest, and deliver to the people of Zimbabwe.
Let me speak about education. Zimbabwe has been known as one of the educational centers of Africa and arguably of the world. So many educated people have come from a Zimbabwean diaspora. You yourself are highly educated. And now you find a situation where people don't have enough money for school fees or to make sure that their kids can stay in school. What would you do or what will you do to ensure that Zimbabwean children once again have the chance to pursue a full education?
The starting point is to make sure that we stabilize our economy, we recover our economy so that the wages that people are earning are enough to buy food, shelter, education and health. So by addressing the economic matters in our country, we'll be able to then create a situation where people can then afford health care. They can afford to send their kids to good schools. Having recovered the economy, having stabilized the economy, then the rest of the social services will then be resolved. Let me emphasize that education is very important because education is an enabler. It's a facilitator for other activities. And once you destroy the educational infrastructure in a country, you've destroyed the life of that country. So it's important that we ensure that we go back to where our schools were producing excellent human capital for our needs in the country, for the needs of the region, and the needs of the globe. It's a major, important matter to us.
So far, the EU and the U.S. have not agreed to lift sanctions against Zimbabwe. Do you think that Zimbabwe will become, once again, much more universally accepted by the international community? And what will it take to make that happen?
We are going to be matters of our destiny if the African leaders have agreed among themselves. If SADC, which is our regional body in Southern Africa, has endorsed our agreement, if the African Union has endorsed our agreement as African leaders, if the UN has welcomed us and embraced our agreement, we expect the Europeans, we expect the Americans, we expect the British to follow suit. They have no moral authority to question the UN, to question the AU, to question SADC's judgment. So we feel that, yes, they might be analyzing and reviewing this and the other matter, but they have no choice but to go ahead and lift those sanctions and go ahead and engage the people of Zimbabwe. But let me emphasize, we do not desire to survive on handouts. We do not desire to survive on aid. We have enough natural resources in our country. We have enough human capital in our country. We need a paradigm shift from aid to economic development, from aid to investment. So we hope to do some healing. Healing of Zimbabwe vis-a-vis the region, healing of Zimbabwe vis-a-vis the rest of Africa, healing of Zimbabwe vis-a-vis Europe, America, and the rest of the world. We seek to have international strategic partners from Europe, from America, from Japan. We also want economic empowerment where our natural resources in Zimbabwe start benefiting Zimbabwe and Zimbabweans. So we are not interested in charity, but investment.
Well, Dr. Mutumbara, it's been great to talk to you, and we hope to talk to you again very soon.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Arthur Mutumbara is Zimbabwe's new deputy prime minister, a role he has been given in the country's new power-sharing agreement. He's also president of a breakaway faction of the Movement for Democratic Change, the main opposition party in Zimbabwe. He spoke with NPR's Farai Chidea by phone from his home in Harare. It's been about 4 years since we've heard from Grammy-nominated artist Eric Benet. Now the R&B singer is back with his new album, Love and Life, which just debuted at number 11 on the Billboard 200 chart. And the first single of the album, You're the Only One, held the number one spot on Urban Adult Contemporary charts for 3 weeks. Eric Benet popped into our studios to speak with News & Notes host Farai Chidea about his new album, about parenthood, and growing through life's lessons.
This was the first time in my career, and this is always something that I wanted to do, but it's happening now, and it's very apropos that it's happening right now, as it should, where the record label just gave me a check and said, okay, this is how much it's going to cost for you to go make a record. Go make a record. And let us hear what you got when you're finished. And that's what I did. I went back home to Milwaukee. I wanted to make a record that was all about going back to the roots, going back to the roots of music, almost like an homage to the kind of R&B and the kind of records that made me fall in love with the idea of becoming an artist.
Well, you have had some incredible success already, both with the album hitting the charts and also the third week for the single, You're the Only One, hitting the number one on the urban radio charts. Give me a sense of where you think your influences are specifically. Give me a song that's on your album, and not a song that it's derivative of, but a song that maybe evokes things for you that was something you might have listened to when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm. You take a song like One More Tomorrow on my record, which is actually a song that was written the day my daughter was born. My daughter's 16 now. But One More Tomorrow I recorded just now for this album, Love and Life. You can, when you hear the strings and the movements of the strings, I mean, you can't help but to, you know, it's not just an R&B string section. It's very classical in its orchestral sensibilities. And that day with you, wouldn't ever take
What's it like singing with your own daughter, who's now in the bloom of her teenage years?
Yeah.
What is it like?
I got to tell you, sometimes India is 16. Sometimes it's what it is like holding back tears sometimes. We just did a few daytime television shows and to promote, to promote the record, because we're always at home singing. We're constantly singing at home. One day I decided to just go. I was sitting at the computer and I thought, well, hey, let me do one of these little YouTube things. I had India come on over and sing. We did an a cappella version of my single, You're the Only One, and just kind of put it out there. And the response was crazy. The response was so great that, you know, some people had asked, okay, Eric, you have a gig on the Today Show. Would it be possible for your daughter to sing background also? We saw the YouTube clip and it was incredible. So, yeah, being on stage, looking over at my incredibly beautiful and talented daughter, doing what she loves so much. She's in love with music as much or not, if more than I was at that age. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing. It really is. I'm blessed in so many areas of my life, and being a father is by far the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And she is my source of happiness. You're still my girl. I don't care what they say. Let's go back to our world. Baby, don't you throw this love away. 'Cause I still believe in the magic of us. It's just a matter of time. And it's a matter of trust. All right, what about your sexy song, Chocolate Legs? Mm-hmm. I'll just be real here. You've made tabloid headlines for issues around sex. Yeah.
And some of your famous relationships.
Right.
When you write a song like that, do you worry that all of a sudden people are flipping back the pages to what they've read about you, whether or not it's something that actually represents you?
I've always been the kind of person who, before all that stuff happened, I've kind of always been the guy who kind of needed people to like me in order to feel good about myself. Going through that process, I had to learn very quickly not to rely upon, me being the most popular and well-liked person. Through the process of that, there was a lot of growth. There was a lot of just relying on my heart, relying on my gut, and keeping, people who are the most important to me and love me the most in my life. So in saying all that, I don't really put a lot of energy into caring what people think anymore. It's the media's job sometimes, in order to sell records, to sell magazines, to get ratings on television. You know, they want to polarize things. They want to make, okay, this person is the villain, this person is the victim, and the story is very clear, so, you know, we can get our message across. That's not always the case, but the bottom line is, yeah, I just kind of go from my gut and don't really give a lot of attention to what others might think, who or what I am. I just try to let my life and the lessons I've learned be the example. From now on.
Have you been able to talk to or chosen to talk to Halle Berry since she's a mom now and say congratulations or anything like that?
Well, we haven't spoken together in about four or five years now, and it's not by my choice, but so through the press or just through putting the message out there that I'm very happy for her and that I want, nothing but happiness, and it looks like she's, I've seen pictures of the baby. It's a beautiful child. How could it not be? And that's about as close as I got to actually congratulating her. But I am happy for her.
From your album, Love and Life, is there any lyric that you wrote that comes to mind that really is meaningful to you?
The first song on the record is called Love, Patience, and Time. If there's anything that I've learned you know, in my years on this planet, it's that the power of God is very much alive, and very much alive in all of us. And we have within us all the tools that we need to overcome whatever personal obstacle or whatever global obstacle we may face. And so I really wanted to start the record off giving people an idea of where my, not only where my mind is at, but, you know, really where my heart is at.
I believe in the power inside of my heart. God is the source from whom we're never apart. No challenge too great and no cause is too small. This infinite love is inside of us all.
That's just kind of my general philosophy of maneuvering our way through this eventful journey, you know, of life.
Well, thanks for coming into the studio.
Very, very much my pleasure.
That was NPR's Farai Tadeya talking with Grammy-nominated artist Eric Benet. He was at our studios at NPR West, and you can watch video of this interview online at nprnewsandviews.org.